you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is a podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Pacell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and Amazon Prime.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, directed both of them. And I'm currently in pre-production on my third feature, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 336 from September 2021 with director Ben Hickernell, who talks about raising the funds for his features, especially his fifth feature, What We Found, which is a whodunit set in high school. We thought this was a good match for Travis because they both made whodunits, but as one for their first feature and one for their fifth feature, and they both talk about how they raised funds. By the way, this episode is one of our most popular episodes ever, so we hope you enjoy it. After that, we play another round of the game, but don't forget to check us out on Patreon and support us there, www.patreon.com/mmihpodcast. But without any more bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Ben Hickernell.
Ben Hickernell, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. Give us the elevator pitch for What We Found for those who didn't listen to your bonus episode from months ago.
Okay, sure. Yeah. What We Found is a teen murder mystery. It's kind of Stand By Me meets The Wire. It's set in Baltimore, where I grew up, and two movies slash show that I love very much. And it's essentially, it's the story of Marcus and Holly, two young best friends who are just starting their senior year of high school. Or sorry, starting their freshman year of high school. They're just starting high school. They're 14 years old. And a friend of theirs who's a senior disappears, and they try to, in West Baltimore, and they try to find out what happened to her. So it kind of borrows from Stand By Me and The Wire and from my childhood. And I was trying to write a fast moving kind of mystery. I've used the word thriller, and I found that's a misnomer because people then expect like John Wick, and it's not that. It's more of a mystery. But I was trying to write a fast moving, exciting movie after doing a bunch of character dramas. But it still has kind of the heart of, it has kind of an indie heart with a lot of character moments as well. So that's the movie. And I'm really proud of the kind of young cast and how it turned out. So yeah, it was great to release it last year.
Thumbnailing 15 questions from that. How many days did you shoot?
That one, well, that's a funny story again, you know, because it always comes down to funding, right? So we wanted to do 25, and then we didn't have the money for that. So we ended up shooting principal in a crazy 18 days, 3 6-day weeks, because that's all we could kind of get. And if you see the movie, I mean, literally they say like, don't do children, water, or animals. We literally have like several minors, like, because we cast actual 14-year-olds too. We didn't do 18-year-olds as 14-year-olds. We did 14-year-olds. So we can only shoot like so many hours a day. So we had minors. We had a major water scene. If you see the movie, you'll see that. And we even had a scene with the dog. So we did everything not supposed to do. We did it in 3 weeks, which was crazy. But that then meant that we did have to do pickups. So we raised some more money later on to fill in some things and reshoot a few things, and did 4 days of pickups that were instrumental to finishing the film. And, you know, originally, if we had done 25 days, we wouldn't need to do that. But that's indie filmmaking, is we just didn't have the money at the time and needed to go. So we did what we could. And then we had to fix some things. But I think, you know, I think in some ways that worked out well, too, because for some of the cast, young cast was very experienced. Some of them, it was their first movie. So I think it gave a few of the younger cast also a chance to kind of like get a second stab at some beats. And that was helpful. That's my cat. That's Charlie. It's he's my director's assistant. He'll be here.
What was the rough budget of the film?
In the end, it's between 600 and 700,000. Under a million. Oh, I should, or should I, you want to edit that? Do we just say under a million?
Well, it's up to you. We want that. We want you to not edit that. We'd like to keep
if
that.
It's already sold and the deals are done, who cares? Right.
Everybody knows. And actually it was funny, cause I kind of tried to play a coy, and distributors are kind of smarter now. Like I tried to play a coy, and then in a few discussions, I was kind of like, under a million. They were like, they're like, yeah, we're guessing around 600,000. And I was, you know, like they kind of can tell now, you know? So anyway, yeah, that's what it was. So that's the real deal.
How did you and Charlie come up with the idea?
I might lock him out in a second. Anyway. So like I said, I'd done at that point, depending on how you count my movies, two or three character dramas. And, you know, a lot of my discussions after making these movies with distributors was like, you know, it's well made, we like it. Oh, you're in South by Southwest, great. But, you know, dramas are hard to sell and not big enough names and et cetera. So I was like, I want to try to do what I do, but do it in a quote unquote, for lack of a better term, more commercial way. So it did start with not a cold calculation, but it kind of started more conceptually. You know, it started with, okay, what kind, it started as a type of movie. And I was like, I want to do, I literally remember at the premiere of A Rising Tide in Seattle, which was great. It was fun, but it was like 9 o'clock on a Friday. And you know, my South by Southwest premiere for Lebanon, PA had been like packed and sold out, right? And then my second movie was like Seattle, 9 o'clock on a Friday, kind of rainy, like 2/3 full. And I just was like, man, like, you know, and I'm really proud of that film too. I'm really not trying to like throw shade on my own films. It was just that I had a kind of moment of clarity at the after party. I was like, you know, movies are, people want to see certain kind of movies. And I was like, my next movie, I need to do something different. And I think said like after a few beers, I was like, my next movie, like end of act one, somebody's getting a bullet to the head, you know? And so that was kind of part of the, honestly, part of the inspiration because, you know, don't want to spoil the movie, but there is a murder. There are murders involved. So that was kind of how it started. And then, so when I was like 13 years old, I used to go camping all the time with my friends. It was kind of our little escape. We would like go skate. We would skateboard off to like the state park, Patapsco State Park in Baltimore, and go camping. And don't tell the park service. We would like, you know, spend the night and go skinny dipping the river and like, you know, like you're not supposed to be there after dark and stuff. But so those experiences kind of informed this movie where these kids do, they go camping in the woods. They're looking for a body in the woods, kind of like Stand By Me. So it kind of became this mystery and this kind of thriller, but also a statement about what it was like for me growing up. Marcus is a young kind of nerdy kid. He's a young nerdy kid who takes a moral stance. And that's kind of the kind of kid I was. I was the kind of kid in like middle school who'd be like, but it's not right, you know, like talking about like, you know, illegal wars or like, you know, I was very into social justice and moral issues. And so when I was writing Marcus, he's also this young kind of nerdy kid who's kind of in a lot of ways like dismissed by his peers, but, you know, he's not like, oh, that's anything wrong with play football. You know, he's not doing some of this stuff like other kids do, normal kids do. He is really interested in these bigger issues. And so then when this person he knows disappears, and a lot of the other kids at the high school are kind of like, you know, man, that sucks. You know, they're not worried, but they're not like, I'm going to do something about it. And he has this kind of moral compass. And he's just like, no, like, I know her. I need to do something about this. And so him and Holly, who's his kind of other more nerdy friend, they go and try to find out what happened to her on their own. And there's a storyline with the police, and there's maybe some corruption there. So there's kind of a reason too why they think maybe the police aren't really quite looking into the way they should. So anyway, so it really comes from that. It came from my childhood experiences and that sense of morality, and that kind of, in a wonderful way, kind of simple morality you can have as a child, where you're just like, this is not right, I'm going to do something. And that's kind of Marcus's thrust. You know, that's what sets him on this path.
And then how long did you spend working on the film from, you know, coming up with the idea to it being released?
Yeah, I don't know. A million years? No, I mean, it was, started writing it in kind of 2016. We shot it in, 2015, 2016, then fundraising. I mean, it's still always the hardest part of the movie. It used to take me a long, long time. Now I do have some funding connections, and it took me about a year and a half to kind of fundraise and get, but like I said, we didn't then have as much as we needed, but you know. So it kind of, in one way, it went on for years. So we went through the whole process, but about a year and a half to get it ready to shoot. Shot in 2018, shot in 2017, then did some pickups in 2018. Had to wait. We edited and waited for the weather to change to do the pickups because we went into winter. So we had to wait for like the spring to come again. Did those pickups and then finished the movie around early 2019. And then it came out in 2020. So you know, it actually was like a 3 or 4 year journey, which some of my movies were like 5 or 6. So that wasn't as crazy.
It's one of my questions later. And I think I might've heard you wrong, but you said something about 2015, 2016. That's when you wrote the script, right?
Because Rising Tide premiered in 2015. So like I said, that party was Seattle, like summer 2015. So it was probably the germ, the seed was there. And then probably 2016 was like in earnest writing. Yeah. And then by end of 2016 was like starting to fundraise and stuff. And then we got it shot in mid 2016. We got it shot in 2017, late 2017.
The last of our rapid fire questions is, compared to all the other films you've ever done, how difficult was this one?
This was, I mean, they're each different in different degrees, right? But this is, in general, was the hardest shoot I'd ever had. And there are a number of reasons for that. And some I won't go into because it has to do with like personalities and stuff, you know, not with any of the cast. The cast was like lovely, but there was some behind the scenes stuff happening. And then it was a big part of it was what was this money shortage that we thought we had more money than we did and had to really scramble at the end to like figure out how to make it happen. And that meant cutting the schedule and cutting scenes. It really was like this, like, you know, like boot camp or this kind of thing of just like, we are going to make this movie happen by any means necessary. And we, you know, buckled, me and the team, and like buckled down and did, and we did, and I'm really proud of it. But it was a grueling shoot. It was crazy. Like every movie I lose, like I lose a few pounds, like during prep, you know, just from the complete busyness and lack of, and stress and like lack of time to like eat and be a human. So, I mean, I don't know how many, I guess there's like a meter of like how many pounds you lose during like prep. And so this was like an 8-pounder. I don't know. It was something, but it was crazy stressful. But then when we were shooting, you know, we had an amazing camera team because we had to move fast. We only had 3 weeks, right? So the camera team was amazing. The cast was amazing. People really pulled in and made it happen. And I'm really grateful for that.
So I'm really curious, like you've made 5 feature films, you know, you like seem to be a career feature film maker, which is amazing. Is this what you do to, pay the bills and everything, or do you have other jobs that you do on the side?
Mostly. Yeah. I mean, actually, and I thought you'd ask that question. I think I used to in the past, like, you know, try to be more, you know, you try to create, cause Hollywood's like all this illusion. You try to create this air of success and like, you try to like, I don't know, but these days I just feel like it's good to be honest and like screw it. Like we're all working so hard. I mean, your podcast is about how hard this is and like everybody's working hard and hustling. So I'll answer honestly and not hiding in the unvarnished truth. But I used to work day jobs all the time. I had a day job even when I made Lebanon PA up until I shot Backwards. I had a full-time day job or more than one, you know, different, lots of different things. I've been working since I was like 15. I was like washing dishes, like, you know, under, off the books, like legally. Like I've just always, I'm not from like money. I've always worked. So always worked gigs and jobs. When I did Backwards, my second movie or my third movie, depending on how you count it, I got paid like a directing check. I mean, because Lebanon PA, I got paid myself $1, right? I worked a full-time day job, paid myself $1, edited the movie like nights and weekends, all that kind of stuff. Or actually days and weekends, because I was working a night job. Backwards let me leave that job. And I haven't had to go back to a full-time job since, which is great. That was 2011. So it's been a decade of basically directing full-time. And so I, you know, direct, I write, I edit. So I've taken other gigs, you know, I've edited commercials. I've edited other narrative projects, like other films and shorts. I did a book trailer for Penguin Books. Like I definitely do a lot of cool gigs and stuff. But I don't, you know, some filmmakers I know, I mean, some are now like directing TV and making like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's amazing. And other ones I know, you know, they do like branded content on the side and they have a good steady thing. I really focus my time on independent filmmaking. So I do a lot of weird gigs. So basically I'll do video gigs. And then sometimes, I mean, like in the last few years, like I've driven Uber, you know, like I've definitely, you know, I've had to hustle. It's not like I get to sit back and rest on my laurels. But I do, you know, I actually wrote... In the last few years, I've written 3 different scripts for hire for other people, which has been fantastic and, you know, getting paid for it. So that's been great. And obviously I work on my films and now I build in like some money for myself on my films. So, but I'm always hustling. And then the funny thing too is like an indie film is how much time you spend on the business side and, you know, like fundraising and promoting and stuff versus like actually making films. So I definitely, too, even when I'm working on my films, yeah, often I'm lucky enough to get to like write for a day and that's great. But other times I'm doing admin and, you know, I'm doing like the books of my old, you know, I still do like, we're still trying to finish the New York tax credit for What We Found. And like, I'm the accountant, you know, like, so I do spend a lot of time working on my films as a producer and as kind of the owner of the LLC versus just being like a director dreaming up stuff. So yeah, you know. But I also consider myself fortunate that I do get to work on my films a decent, you know, a good amount of my time. And that's been my full-time job for 10 years, which is awesome.
I want to talk a little bit about what you said about genre, because it's actually what you did is what I'm trying to do. after like doing dramedies and character based pieces and personal films, I'm like, wait a second, this is not making me any money. Like, I'm going to see, I'm going to try to level up commercially in a different way. And I guess looking at your CV and just by what you said, you're very impressive, very prolific. Do you feel like you've been consistently leveling up? And B, do you think this turn into genre has helped you?
It's weird. The business is very schizophrenic and fickle. So back when I made Lebanon PA, which was came out in 2011, it was a total character drama. And at that point, everybody I met with some managers and agents and stuff, and they were like, oh, you know, this is great, but like, you know, you're kind of like a Tom McCarthy figure. You know, he doesn't really make us any money. He's like prestige. He's like getting us Oscars. He's like, you know, so they were like, you should really kind of lean into genre, and like, there's no space for drama in movies anymore. But that was before the streaming boom and all the drama like series blew up. So the funny thing is, I feel like the path, one of the biggest successful paths for an indie filmmaker now is make a really cool, idiosyncratic, personal movie, and then make a TV, make a series out of it for like a streamer. But that didn't exist yet. So the funny thing is, I feel like I pivoted. So that's all I'm saying is that I was told, do something more commercial. So then I did A Rising Tide, which was more, it was still a character drama, but it was more of like a romance. It was a foodie movie. It's about a chef. So it was about like beautiful food and romance set at the Jersey Shore. And that was my more like, my more commercial, still a drama, more commercial drama. And that actually, you know, did pretty well in certain ways. We actually turned a profit on that movie, which is like awesome. And made my, you know, made me and my investors very happy and proud. But it didn't make like a big splash with industry people or anything. And so then what we found was me leaning into genre. And the very funny thing is, once that hit the distributors and we were pitching it and stuff, the two things we heard was that it wasn't kind of, it was too mainstream, wasn't idiosyncratic enough. For like, especially for the festivals and some of the more like really indie distributors. And then the more mainstream people were just like we got somebody to watch it at Netflix through a friend, which was great. And they watched it, and their main thing was, yeah, it's great. It's just, it's too low budget. And that's a funny thing. We're like, because, you know, when Netflix makes like, you know, a low budget Netflix movie, like, oh, no stars. And it's like a teen movie at a high school, because our movie was a teen movie at high school. They spent $15 million. You know, our movie was. So the basic thing was, they were like, oh, it's well made. Yeah. Good performances. You know, yeah, we good watch. But, you know, it just doesn't represent our, it's too low budget for our brand. So the funny thing is, I feel like no matter what you make, the industry tells you something kind of, they want something different. And so I definitely, this next movie I'm writing is commercial, but is also, I'm kind of going for it more and just being as personal as I can be, because I feel like in a nice way, that's one way the business has changed with streaming, is people are finding more niche audiences. And so you're able to just, they want distinct voices, and that's a positive as a filmmaker. So anyway, so I think the funny thing is, so Liz asked if it had helped me. And I mean, the answer is not really, because each time they kind of want a different thing. It was very funny. It was like, especially the film festivals were just like, you know, because I have relationships with some of them, because I've been at some of them, and they were just like, I'm like, oh, it was a fun watch. We really liked it. They're like, but it's just too mainstream for a festival. And then the distributors were kind of like, it's without repeating myself, it's a very funny thing. And you have to think about what will find an audience and what distributors, et cetera, want. But also, they don't really know what they want. So I think you always, it is true that you have to just stick to yourself and your voice and make something that has a strong voice. And that's, you know, that then hopefully it'll find its people.
Do you feel though that you are leveled up? Like, what is, do you like, I know that's just esoteric, but do you feel like you are?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like each movie gets better. You know, that's something I like, is I feel like I'm very proud of what we found. And I think for lack of a better term, for the average person watching that movie, it's my best movie. It moves the fastest. It's the smoothest in terms of like performances. It has the most twists. It's just the most fun to watch. But I think Lebanon PA, which is set in like rural Pennsylvania and is about a young girl who gets pregnant and is kind of deciding whether or not to have an abortion, is this very like personal film, and is a little more idiosyncratic because my extended family is all from central Pennsylvania. So I had all these little, and I wish I even had more touches. That's a whole other story about the production of that film. But you know, I have these little personal touches. So I think in some ways though, that movie still, it depends on the audience member, but like, I think indie film people, especially when they see that movie, they feel like that's my purest. I have friends who watch and they go, that's you, that's your purest movie. So it's funny, but I feel personally that I do get better with each movie. And And that's, you know, that's a good feeling because you want to develop as an artist. You want to push yourself. And each movie, I try to push myself in a different way. And I do feel that, you know, each movie gets better. Of course, whether the industry, whether people find it is a very different question. But yeah.
So we're a year out of what we found coming out roughly. How has it done business wise? Like, have you gotten a return on your investment? Like, you know, has it at least proven to some extent that like genre is, you know, going to pay better than drama?
Well, I don't really know if that's the case anymore because of streaming and because of, you know, these series where yes, there isn't like box office, but they get viewers, they get a lot of cultural attention, streamers pay a lot for them. So I'm not saying that's totally a thesis, you know, in terms of filmmaking, but, yeah, I mean, audiences found it. I mean, we haven't, audiences found it. We haven't made like a profit yet, obviously. That's going to take some time and hopefully we'll get there. But the first quarter was strong. And we estimated, because it's hard, you just get money numbers and you have to extrapolate like, well, okay, like what's the share of who's getting what share of what, you know, 60% versus 40%, et cetera, like who's getting what share of that dollar value. Anyway, so we have extrapolated and guessed a 250,000 people or so into the movie the first quarter, which is awesome for a movie with, you know, we spent a few hundred bucks on Facebook ads and I was like full-time social mediaing for 2 months, but we didn't have a major festival. We were originally going to open in LA and Baltimore in theaters to get some press and try to drive that. Theaters were shut. So we played a few theaters in kind of like far corners, like Florida and Washington State and like Maine, like places that were open, but not like the big cities. But yet we broke through and like 250,000 people rented it the first quarter. So it's, you know, it has money coming in. I've already sent checks back to the investors for a chunk for the first quarter. So yeah, you know, I think for an indie film, it's definitely pretty successful and on a path to hopefully keep. We were doing some foreign deals now. It just sold to several territories. So yeah, it's getting out there and that's, you know, I'm very proud of that. It's a lot of work.
And you did like, you know, orchestrated like a re-release, right? Recently, or I don't know how you worded it in your, but can you tell us about that?
Of A Rising Tide?
Damn it. It was A Rising Tide. It wasn't Lonely
Fun. It was A Rising Tide, yeah.
Okay. On the show weeks ago, I misinformed everyone. And I was like, well, I think Ben's doing this like re-release thing. And I totally swapped the titles. Okay. Well, so you're re-releasing Rising Tide then. That's really interesting.
So A Rising Tide made money. So we had Seattle and then we had a good festival run. And then what we did is we got a foreign TV deal for A Rising Tide, which was wonderful because we basically sold it in this foreign TV package that made us back. Like actually we got an MG, made back like half the budget on like, you know, signing the contract, half the budget back, and then over time made more. And basically it was a very good foreign TV deal. So it was on pay TV, you know, like premium cable, Sky and HBO equivalent, et cetera, around the world. But it never really had much of a US release. We had a small US distributor who picked it up and basically did like some streaming stuff with it, not like Hulu and Netflix, but like, you know, streaming with ads on like Tubi and Pluto and Amazon Prime and et cetera. And they just weren't doing much with it. So then we actually got the distributor of What We Found, because we had a good relationship there and we were getting on so well, they were like, we'll put it out. And so they put it out on like a bunch of platforms just last month. July, came out early July. So we're still trying to promote that a bit. And it's just great because, like, you know, it's a US-based movie. So A Rising Tide is, because I haven't described that one yet, is a love story and a foodie movie about a community rebuilding set after Hurricane Sandy in Atlantic City, New Jersey. At that time, I was living in Philadelphia. I used to spend a lot of time down the shore. Again, I like to set things not like in, not that I never will, but like outer space or New York. I like to set things in like kind of smaller, more idiosyncratic parts of America that aren't seen as film on film as often, and often a place I have a personal connection to. So this was set at the Jersey Shore. And it was set after Hurricane Sandy. And I think actually it really is a great kind of parable for the COVID times, because it's really about how a community comes together and tries to heal and rebuild. And especially how the different strata of that, there's kind of an economic message, the different strata of that community need to come together. And that unless every strata kind of is part of the community and engages, then the network of the community falls apart. So anyway, so that's what it's about. And you know, the public, or not the public, but like a lot of people really hadn't seen it because it's on just these few little streaming services. So now that it's on everything, I'm actually finding messages from people and stuff are like, oh, I saw it. It was great. It was on Showtime in the US. So like our core, like our funders and et cetera, saw it when it was on running on Showtime in the US, but a lot of people hadn't seen it. So we're finding a new audience and that's been really nice. Give it new life.
So, you know, you mentioned, you know, your investors on what we found. This is the question I ask everybody. How did you find your investors? Like, are these people who invested in your older movies? This is like a whole new group of investors. Like, how did this come together?
I don't know if I'm repeating other people. I mean, my theory on indie film investment in the US, because indie film investment in the US is very different from, you know, if you're in Europe or Canada, there's more established pathways, there's public funding, you know, the national lottery in the UK, et cetera. So then you have these more established pathways. In America, they're really, because you know, we love our freedom, there isn't really an established pathway. It comes down to basically begging rich people for money. That's the American model, for lack of a better term. And luckily, you know, some rich people are very nice and care about the arts and are interested in investing or donating to movies. And I find in general, this is a generalization, but in general, there are three ways indie films get funded. First, there's the I'm in that sphere way. Of like, you know, someone's rich uncle, you know, it's the son, daughter, niece, nephew of either somebody wealthy or somebody kind of connected, like a famous, you know, movie person, something like that. And you look at like Sundance, et cetera, and, you know, I really feel like almost half the indie films or more are funded in that model where someone knows someone and it's like, wow, your first movie was $4 million. Where'd you get that? And it's like, yeah, you know, it was Aunt Janice, you know, or whoever, Uncle Ted. So there's that model. Then there are established production companies, you know, like these awesome, you know, like Killer Films and et cetera, who do find new voices, new talent and get movies made. And they're kind of the awesome, like, I don't know, Valkyries, like riding on, you know, like fighting for indie film. But I really feel like that's a very, very small percentage of films. Only so many of them, they only make so many films. And then also too, they tend to work with the same filmmakers. So they find some new talent. Yes, they do. But often they make, you'll see, you know, they work with the same director again and again and again. So then after that person's first film, it's really not like finding new talent. Anyway, so that's like, I don't know, 10% of films. And then I'm in that final 25-30% of the, like, I come from, you know, I know it's everybody in America says a middle class, but I come from a middle class family. I had like no family connections to money, you know, so people like us, and I'm sure Liz is very similar, actually, just kind of nail it together, you know, like literally, like it's like you put the ship together piece by piece. And so I literally raise money in, you know, $2,500 chunks, $5,000 chunks, $50,000 chunks, $100,000 chunks. And the way I got started was my first years out of college, I was doing theater in the Philadelphia area. I lived in Philly for the first like decade after college, and I was basically doing like the Fringe Festival and doing local Philadelphia theater, et cetera. And through that, I met Philadelphia has a kind of longtime culture of philanthropy, and there's kind of like some old money there, et cetera. And people there do support the arts and these theater companies. So I met people through that. That basically, like, you know, like I was acting in a play or like assistant directing a play and like opening night gala, you know, you have the people who, like, when you look in the back of the program, the, like, you know, the founder's circle and the et cetera, those people who like supported the arts in Philadelphia, I met some of them through that. And that was how I got started. Is then I did a first tiny movie. So if you count my movies, if you count me as having to do five movies, my first movie was a tiny little $10,000 movie called Cellar. $10,000 is a lot, but it's not a lot for a movie. And I played some festivals and stuff, but never got released because it was just a very small movie. But the way I did that was some of the people who I had met who donated to theater companies, et cetera, we actually produced it through a theater company, but did this weird like film theater hybrid and got some donations. And that was my first experience. And then when I did Lebanon, PA, I expanded on some of those contacts because that first little movie, Cellar, did well. It actually won a Barrymore Award, which is the Philadelphia Theater Awards. So you haven't heard of it in LA, but in Philadelphia, it's like the biggest, like one of the biggest arts things. We won an award. We got attention, you know, et cetera. It did well. Played the Philadelphia Film Festival, won like the best local film that year. And so off of that, then I started making Lebanon, PA, which is another Pennsylvania-based film. And that movie ended up being over 300,000. We started off trying to do it for about $250,000, and I got some donations, some investments, and then Lebanon, PA was, I mean, we were riding completely on the seat of our pants. I mean, a quarter of the movie was on my credit cards. So when it come time, when it came to finish that movie and like sell that movie, it was like life or death. Like I had to get that movie released or I had this massive amount of debt. So, you know, it was since then I've just always been so intricately involved with the movies. You know, I just get it done, and it's not like, yeah, I don't get that angel check for like $3 million from someone. It's never had that happen.
So just to kind of like get into the nitty gritty of this a little bit more, it's like you met some contacts through the theater world, you made a movie, it did pretty well. And then you just met more people through that basically. But like,
yeah. Cause then suddenly, okay, you're in the newspaper and like, you know, you're a filmmaker. And then, so through some of the money people, I met other money people. Also through, you know, through cold contacts, it's not like they all came to me. You know, I was definitely, as I was making Lemon and PA, I was reaching out to everybody I could through any connection I could. So it was me seeking people out, either cold calling or emailing, or kind of, yes, meeting someone through a person. And then one of my investors for Lemon and PA did find me because, I can't remember exactly, but we got some newspaper articles and she then contacted me. I think there was some kind of mutual connection, but she contacted me because she was like, I'm really interested in this. Can we talk about it? And we had lunch. And then, you know, afterwards she was like, well, I'd like to like invest in your movie. And that was great. But again, that was like a 25 grand check. You know, it's not like, it's bit [S2] Right. [S1] by bit. So my Lebanon PA took about 2.5 years of fundraising of just chasing money. And, you know, you get it turned down more often than you get a yes, obviously.
I remember when go on.
Sorry. When you're cold calling, like who are you cold calling? Like, and where are you finding these people to cold call? Are you cold calling production companies, like managers, like, or is it like actually individuals who you think may have money and may be interested in supporting the arts? Like how did you find your list to like even do those cold calling emails or calls?
Yeah. So for that movie, especially for that size, it was private equity and literally, and this was, 2000 and the wilds of 2007 or 8. So it literally started with like literally a notepad, like a piece of paper, a legal pad. And I just wrote down everybody I'd met, mostly in the Philadelphia theater kind of community, but also anybody I'd met who had money, connections to money, who might be interested in the arts. I just literally made a list. And then, yeah, started, you know, not cold calling like someone's, you know, home or, but kind of through emails, writing polite, you know, kind of brief, trying to be brief, you know, emails, but with a little bit of passion saying, you know, would you consider getting coffee with me? I'm trying to, you know, I've done this, I've won these awards in this thing. I'm trying to make a new project. I am introduced to this person, whatever, would you get coffee with me in chat? And you know, you get a lot of no's and then I got a few yeses and then you try to turn that coffee meeting into, and the main thing too is to not, I think, and I'm sure you guys have kind of heard about this too, but you know, you try to have a relationship with people. Like, you know, you can't force someone into investing in your movie and you can't, I always try to offer something, you know what I mean? And I know I can't offer that much, but I always try to like, get to know the person. Usually there's a reason there has to be a reason they want to invest because they know it's, their investments are in stocks and real estate. They're doing this because they either care about the subject matter of your movie. Maybe they, and this often happens, they have a son or daughter who like wants to act or wants to edit or so, you know, we definitely have people who came and like were our edit assistant or like gave a few lines in the movie. Like, you know, you try to involve them in a way that, and also sometimes too, you know, they just care about the arts and they kind of want to be involved. They want to be on set. They want to meet the actors and see how it works and et cetera. And, you know, for this person, $50,000, you know, is very similar to like, if I ask my parents for like $500 cause like my car got, you know, it's just, they're on a different scale. It's someone of means who for them, $50,000 is not that a crazy amount of money. So I wish there was cause this is the golden question everybody asks. And my next movie, I'm trying to do a bigger movie. So I am trying to pitch more to production companies. And it's not that I didn't pitch to production companies before, but I find an indie film often there's this weird chicken egg thing where most of the production companies, where Rising Tide went out to production companies, a lot of them basically like, you know, they want you to be 90% of the way there. They're like, well, if you have all the money and you have the actors attached and you're about to shoot, then sure, we'll fund you. But like you have, so in the end, I end up just kind of doing it myself. Not, you know, just because that's the only way it can happen. And I wish there was a better answer, like be like, yes, you know, you go to this book and there's a list of names and there's a process. Right. But that's what I'm saying about America. There isn't any process. It is just going out and bit by bit, for me anyway. I mean, maybe there is once you get to like, you know, production companies and you're doing a $5 million movie and you have a manager who's like, I don't know, I'm sure there is. But so far in my career, it's been by any means necessary, bit by bit.
And I just want to say really quickly that like I did the exact same thing. And I think that that is the game plan. That is the process, is like write down a list of everyone you know who has money and then just start there and branch out. And I tell that to people and they look at me with a blank face like, really? And I'm like, yeah, really? It'll take you like 3 or 4 years, but eventually you'll get there.
Well, I just remember, Ben, that like a few years ago, you very kindly met me, I think, at work. And I was like, please tell me the secret of your ways. And you shared this story. And I remember I was like, you just ask them for money. And you're like, yeah. I mean, like you develop a relationship, but you're direct with what you need. And it was mind blowing to me that you would just say exactly what you needed in a conversation. And I think a lot of people are fearful of saying what they want in those kind of scenarios. They don't want to offend, they don't want to burn bridges, and there's something very scary about it. So I'm just, if you can kind of speak to that, because I'm sure you've also had to answer this question before too. It's like, how do you get past the barrier of just saying, I need the support, I need the money to someone like that?
Well, again, I don't think I've ever talked to anyone who hasn't already done this in some capacity. You know, it's someone who's invested in another movie or has, you know, they already donate, you know, $100,000 a year to X theater company, et cetera, because, you know, they have the means and they care about the art. So for me, it was never this kind of extraordinary thing, and you know, as in it was like coming out of nowhere. And like I said, you try to develop a relationship first, you know, it's people who, and once you're doing the first one is the hardest, because then you have no track record. And you also have no, like some of the people I met from my later films, I met, you know, through other films. So like, you know, then you're at the Philadelphia Film Festival, for instance, in Philadelphia, or I didn't meet anybody at South by Southwest, but an example would be you're at South by Southwest, and you're chatting at the after party with someone. And it's like, oh, you know, this person invested in that film. Oh, well, I made this film. And they're like, oh, I saw that, I loved it. I mean, there's a natural thing there where if they're already into this in general, they're into film, they love cinema, they've already invested in things. And now you're at this, like, again, this didn't happen at South by, I wish it had, but you know, that's a natural thing. So it's become more natural. At the beginning, it was, but then again, like I said, you know, my first movie I did for $10,000. So that's a lot of money, but in some ways that was a few donations of like $2,500. Like, and then some, like, I literally threw a fundraising party where it was like, you know, $50 a pop. People came and paid $50. And like, I had, you know, beer and I, you know, we did a little show and stuff. But so again, like a big spectrum. But the point was, I already did that. And that then proved I could do this. I did it. There was a finished film. I could give you a DVD. It had won awards for Philadelphia, a major award. It had won, like, you know, this major award. We'd gotten like stories in the Philadelphia City paper and mentions, you know, in the Inquirer. Like, so I don't know. So it is building. It's proving you can do it. It's then convincing someone with your passion that you have a vision for this thing, but you have to find people who are already interested in this and have some kind of reason to want to be involved. And then, yes, it's about, like, if you meet someone, the first thing you say is, you know, hey, give me a check for $50,000. That's never going to, you have to kind of, you know, so again, if someone has a natural interest, that's what I mean. I don't mean it in a cynical way. I'm not trying to manipulate. I really try to give them something. Cause I know that it's, that's kind of what they want out of it. So very often I try to find what that person wants. And so, you know, sometimes it's an issue. Like, I care about, I actually didn't find anyone for Lebanon PA who was like, I am so strongly pro-choice. I want to see a movie made about this. But, you know, that would have been a natural thing of someone being like, I care about this issue. I think the one woman I mentioned who I met, I think she probably, when she read the script, she probably responded to that. You know, I think she probably liked that, but we didn't really discuss that as like the main reason. The main reason was she had kind of, you know, loved movies and had never been on a set before and kind of thought it'd be fun to be a part of it, you know? And she, I definitely have a lot of investors who I think honestly never read the whole script. They might read a little packet. Maybe they read a page, I don't know, you know, and they maybe come by set once or they never come at all. You know, she was someone who, she was on set almost every day. She was, you know, there and was a part of it. And so there was a natural reason why she wanted to do this, you know, and she was, you know, someone who was, I don't think she wasn't as wealthy as some of my investors, you know, but she was like, retired and in like her 60s, and you know, it was kind of a fun thing to do, and she had the means where, you know, that investment wasn't a crazy thing to do, and then that was her like fun summer, like hanging out with us on the film set, and she came to South by Southwest and everything. So, you know, well, anyway, so did that answer your question? Sorry, I feel like I'm talking, but it literally, there isn't, so in a half an hour lunch conversation, it's about having a conversation with them as a person, and there isn't like one magic moment where it's just kind of having a natural conversation that at some point saying, okay, well, I know you're interested in this. I have this project. I've explained it to you. And this is why I really feel it's important. And this is, you know, an important maybe message, an important story. This is our path to how we think we can do it. And, you know, would you consider, and then you just ask the question, would you consider investing $25,000? And then you see what they say. You know, well, they either say yes, no, or maybe.
I think what would console people is if you just say, or I mean, I don't want to lead you on, but if you just say whether you ever horrifically offended someone or it blew up in your face or it ever went very poorly, just saying exactly what you wanted.
Not really, but yeah, I mean, I can only think of one example. And I don't want to go into it because in case I don't want to like offend that person.
But that's one out of like many. So it sounds like the odds are fairly good.
And you do. I mean, people are usually kind of flattered. Again, you have to do it this way. You can't just ask up front. You have to kind of talk with the person, develop a relationship. And then usually people are kind of flattered. And then you target your asks, right? So if it's someone who's really wealthy, then maybe you are asking for, depends on the scale of your movie, $100,000 or, you know, $1 million, you know, or if it's someone who's not, you know, that wealthy, but you know they have some, like I said, then maybe it's $10,000, $20,000, whatever it is. And so, you know, in that way too, if you are showing, I think if they know you're coming at it from an honest place where you really care about this thing, and because people respond to ambition, you know, I think people respond to this sense of, here's a young, not that I'm so young anymore, here's a young person who's passionate and trying to do something. And yeah, and so it can't hurt to ask. And I really think you have to think about how you do it. And I think do it with an open heart. I guess that's my, which is esoteric, but I think is true, is if you're doing it in kind of like a, you expect something way, or in a, I don't know, if you're weird about it, it'll get weird. But if you ask with an open heart and you're just like, I really care about this, would you please consider being a part of this, being a part? And then always too, I always offer them to be a part of it. A lot of them don't come to set, but I'm always like, come, I don't say just give me money. I say, you know, come be a part of this thing. And I mean that, you know, they're part of the family because they're another, just like the crew and the cast and, you know, the investors are part of the family. And I try to involve them as family. And then come on set, then come to the premiere, you know, I try to involve them in the same way I involve other people.
Yeah, this is like, you're basically saying the exact same thing I would say if someone asked me the question. So it's like, it's really comforting to hear that it's like, I'm not doing anything different than anyone else. Like, this is what you have to do, you know?
But then there is that tough question of scaling up because that's right. The tough thing is, you know, certain people know people who can write $5 million checks and a lot of us don't. So then the question is how you scale up. And that's a whole other question.
I have one last question before we go to final five, but Alric, do you
go first, Liz.
Okay. You're having a baby soon.
I am.
It's coming out of you. And Alric just had a baby and been a topic. He came out of him awesome. Too. And this has been a topic as of late, the idea of a balance is a myth, but how do you prepare? And then, you know, what's your plan? Can you talk a little bit about your plan?
Man, get as far as I can on this new movie before the baby comes. Is right now my kind of panic plan. I mean, you know much better than me because you guys are doing it. I'm not doing it yet. I think I'm probably over. I have a lot of friends who say, and actually Liz is one of those friends who said, like, it is possible. You just focus, you get stuff done, you have time with our napping, you have time with your partner, what, you know, whatever. Because right now I'm panicking that I'm never going to have any time, you know. So I'm trying to relax and think, okay, there'll be some time. But obviously, too, you're devoting a lot of your energy to this little creature. And so I'm not quite sure what'll happen. I'm trying to get this movie to a certain goalpost. I'm trying to get it in active development before the kid's born, so then we can keep pushing it forward. But like, I have the production team on, we have some first money raised, we're kind of getting it moving. So that's what I'm trying to work on right now on my new film. And then, I mean, yeah, you know, I'm praying to God and to Joe Biden for this infrastructure plan, because honestly, it makes such a difference. Like, you know, childcare is a big thing. Like, if, you know, we have friends who pay like $2,800 a month for childcare in LA, right? So that's like another mortgage. So, you know, if we can
28?
Find a place, yeah.
Is that for two children? Because that's insane for one. Oh my God.
That's for one, but you know, whatever. I mean, I'm sure they're cheap. So anyway, so if we end up finding something that's, you know, I just kind of do the math in my head of like, okay, if we find a place that's more like $2,000 or $1,800. I mean, if you guys know some places, start
mine's
giving me
12, names. But it started out at 16 and an infant. I'm just saying, like, I got you in terms of my daycare.
I'm just saying it's crazy, but I'm saying, you know, if we can then pay whatever it is, $1,800, whatever, but then we're getting $500 or $600 a month from the government, you know, because they're talking about in this infrastructure bill. I mean, it's literally this infrastructure bill stuff. We're talking about movies, but it's really life or death. It's especially, I mean, and you look at like filmmaking, that makes such a difference. Because then, okay, then we get down to like 1200 or so a month. That seems doable. You know, that's like, okay, so then we can have childcare and we can focus on work. When it's 2800, it just seems like, God, that's so much. Right. It's rough. So we're hoping for childcare. We're going to support each other. My wife, luckily, she works for UCLA and they have a decent amount of, you know, maternity, et cetera. So, you know, we're kind of taking it as it goes. In the first few months, she'll be off for the first like 3 months at least. She'll be here. I'll be here. We'll be figuring it out. And I don't know, but I think the long-term goal is just, I see people who are doing it, who are having a kid and still having a career. And so I'm going to try to figure that out and do the same thing. And I'm excited to have a kid. So I don't want to, you know, go into it thinking, oh man, it's either or. I feel like that's not a choice we should have to make as filmmakers, as artists, as people. So I'm going to try to find a balance. But yeah, you're asking the wrong guy because I haven't had the kid yet. So ask me like next year and I'll let you know how it's going.
I came up with a final question. You know, you've raised money for 5 feature films. Does it get easier? Was it easier to raise money for the 5th than it was for the 2nd, for instance?
Yes. But scaling up is the big question. So this next movie I want to do for a few million dollars, like just because of that Netflix. I mean, because this is a bigger story. I'm doing a climate change movie that I feel like is the best thing I've written. And I feel like is an important story to get made. But it's a bigger story. So it takes a little more money. So there are story reasons why. But also career wise, that Netflix answer of, oh, you made a great movie. Good job. But, you know, it's not big enough. It doesn't cost enough. It doesn't look big enough. You know, you only have like 3 extras in that scene. You should have 100, you know, like that kind of stuff means also career wise, that is the next step. And so that's my next question is I could probably again go out with my contacts and raise a similar type budget. But how do I get to like 5 million or, you know, whatever. We're still trying to figure out exactly how much we need for this movie. That's the next question. And that's what I'm trying to work with. I'm trying to work with some other more established producers or production companies to kind of make this next movie happen. So yes, it gets easier, but it's not easier for me. I feel like actually this next movie could in some ways be the hardest one to do because I have to find this path to a bigger budget. And that's a new beast.
Wow. Awesome. Let's do final 5. I'll go first. What's the first film you ever made and how do you feel about it now?
First film I ever made. Okay. First feature or non-feature?
Can be anything.
I'm going to do first feature. The first feature I made was called Tough Cookies 3. I shot it junior, senior year of high school. It is a feature film. We shot on SVHS. That's Super VHS for you young people. Had a slightly better resolution or something. Not a bit rate.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just a little bit better. Yeah, it's like what they use in broadcast at the time.
So we shot it on SVHS. I edited it deck to deck, and I'm really proud of it. And it's basically there was a superhero team called the Tough Cookies. It's a long story. Clyde Sugarwater, Duncan Hines were some of the characters. I was Clyde Sugarwater, and it was basically me and my friends putting on bad kind of costumes and fighting bad guys. And crazy enough, and it was a feature film. I mean, we shot this whole thing. It was a big project. We shot in our high school, obviously pre-Columbine. This is just a few years before Columbine. We had toy guns. We had a dummy. We had this one dummy that we threw. And luckily, our school was supportive. So our vice principal, Tanner, thank you, Jay Tanner, he let us shoot in this high school while there was like cleaning it for the summer. So we're like running down the hallways, like, you know, using a skateboard dolly, like me, like on the skateboard with the camera, like running down the hallway, doing action scenes, doing really bad fake kung fu. We had this one dummy that we threw off every time a person got, we threw it off the roof of the high school. So like anytime a guy got like kind of stabbed or shot or like thrown off the building or something, it was this dummy. We ran over with a car. It was crazy. And it was, you know, in some ways, you know, awful, but in some ways the best thing I'll ever make because it was so pure. No lights, no, we literally had a boom mic duct taped to the end of one of those old yardstick rulers, like a full yardstick, and like with like a cord that went into the camera for like dialogue scenes when we needed like good audio. And then we unplugged that when we were doing action stuff. No lights, nothing else. And it's awesome. And now I want to watch it right now.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Oh man. I interned with This Is That in 2003, which is a very formative experience. And that was Ted Hope, Anthony Bregman, and Ann Carey were the three producers. It was the remnants of what was Good Machine, which was my, Good Machine was my like mecca in the 90s. I was like, this is what I want to do. These are the kind of movies I want to make. And this is, they had a Good Machine. This is the, they had a lot of integrity and a good ethos. Anyway, so I interned with This Is That, which was kind of the remnants of Good Machine. Met Ang Lee there, who was probably my favorite director. Michel Gondry, they were doing Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind at that point. They did that movie. And what was so interesting with that is I've always been kind of this lone cowboy, as I was like describing, and they had found this really good core group of collaborators, and they basically were like, and I think part of the message or advice doesn't hold up as well in this day and age, but it should if the world was right. They said, like, find good people and find a good place. And the place is the part that maybe doesn't hold up as well, because they had this office and like people would just stop by, you know, like Michel Gondry stopped by for a meeting. And like, there was this sense of community and this sense of this filmmaking culture that it's just, it wasn't a scene like in a cool way, but it was just a literal place where amazing people came in every day. And now we're all virtual and Zooming and all, you know, split apart. But I think in some ways, I wish we get back to that. And also, office space is expensive. But basically, they had a place and they had good people in that place. And like, I remember Ted Hope said, Ted Hope had worked with James Seamus a lot. And some people know who James Seamus is. He ran Focus Features for years. He was like, they had met at NYU. And he was like, I knew, like, when I first started talking to this guy, that he was smarter than me. But he kind of thought I was smarter than him. So we each thought we were smarter than each other. So the great thing was, whenever we had an idea, I would run it by that other person. We would bounce ideas off each other. And if we both knew it was a good idea, we knew it was like a good idea. Do you know what I mean? And so that partnership, that, so basically find good collaborators and find a good place or vibe, I think is really, really true. Because an indie film, we don't have money. So our biggest commodity is people. And you're always searching for good people to work with. And that's what'll help elevate, A, get your thing made, and B, elevate it to something awesome.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
You know, it changes with time. Like, I used to want to make, you know, giant movies. And I mean, one goal is just direct Star Trek. I was a young nerd. I loved Star Trek so much. Someday I want to direct something Star Trek. But as you get older, it, you know, it does change a bit. And I think right now, especially about to have a kid, I just want to be happy in what I do, treat people well, make good projects that have integrity, both like in what they're saying and with the message they're putting out there and kind of the story they're telling, and that move people, but also have integrity in terms of the way they're made and the people you work with. So I basically just want to like make good stuff, work with good people, and have enough money to just like, you know, the basics of life, like feed my kid, put my kid through school, like have a house, you know, it's really simple stuff, but like that is what I want to do. And like, I'd almost rather work on, I'd love to do, I mean, right now, like I think my favorite thing to do, I'm making a movie, so I want to make movies, but it's compared to making some $200 million movie is more like make a really great series for a streamer on like a smaller budget, but that we know is like really great and moves people. I mean, the most beautiful thing I've seen probably on screen in the past, like during COVID for me was Normal People. I just love Normal People so much. And it was so simple. It's mostly two people in a room and it was just so beautiful. So, because it just felt so real and it felt like real life. And I kind of cried every episode. So I think making good stuff, doing it well, and then having the basic necessities of life are kind of the main goals, and direct Star Trek.
If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
Funny enough, it's a funny balance, right? People say they don't want egomaniac directors. And I've tried to take that to heart. I'm in general a nice guy, a nice person. So I in general really try to be collaborative and listen. I think in overall, that's a really good thing. But the one thing that I Monday morning quarterback, or the one thing that I go back and kind of kick myself for, are some decisions where I really felt something in my gut as the director. But to be a good person and to work with the team and not be, you know, an egomaniac director, I was like, okay. And I thought about it and I said, okay, let's find a middle ground. Let's either compromise or let's do what you say, other member of the team, which overall you think is a really good instinct. And it really is. It's a good thing to be, but there's a reason you know, James Cameron made, like, there's a reason sometimes you have to, like, be that crazy director. Sometimes you do know. And basically, I can think of several calls where I compromised and I really wished I hadn't, because once the movie was finished, I knew if I had just done what I knew in my gut was right, even though the crew would have kind of grumbled, or, like, you know, I would have had to, I don't know, it would have been better. So I really feel like you should be collaborative. You should be, you know, discuss. That's a lot of the strength your team brings to the movie is obviously their perspective and their skills and et cetera. But you in the end are the director of your project and you have a vision. And when you know something in your gut is right, I think you should stick to that kind of all the way, because there's a reason that's there, you know. And I'm often a writer director, so maybe it's a bit different too when you're adapting something, or like you're directing TV and you're working, obviously you're working with a showrunner and a writing team. But especially when you're a writer director, just nobody knows the material better than you. You've lived with it for so long, and just when you have that feeling in your gut, I think really go for it. Because there are several times where I've outthought my gut, and more often than not, I regret having done that. Mm.
I love that advice, because I felt that way after I'm just finishing up my first feature. And I felt that, like, I listened to people too much. And, like, there were some times where I should have, and it was good that I conceded. But in some instances, I definitely should have just done what I wanted to do, what I had written for 4 years. It's like, that was there for a reason. Don't change things last minute. I mean, some things I did change last minute were great, but don't change everything. Anyways.
Well, I would say too, the way you know in your gut is if you have an answer, right? Is if some way, if a crew member, you know, the DP, whoever comes to you and says, well, why should it be that way? The instances I'm thinking about, I had an answer. Mm-hmm. And I maybe even said the answer. I said, I think it should be this way because of this. And I was like, but okay, let's. So if you have an answer, if you can answer the question, then I think follow that. If you don't have an answer, but just like, well, just because I said so, then yeah, maybe that's not the thing. But kind of like you're saying, when you live with it for 4 years and you know, no, this is the reason that scene should be that way. This is the reason this beat needs to hit this way. And you have that answer, you know, trust that.
And then final question, is making movies hard?
Yes, but it's hard. It's painful and there's sacrifice, but occasionally it's wonderful. And I was just thinking of somebody, I can't remember what the example was. There was an example of this and I forgot, but it doesn't matter. The thing is, it does live beyond you. I think that's one of the most beautiful things about making a movie, is you're doing something. Again, who knows if people will watch it, because like 90% of the movies before 1940 are lost or whatever, right? But, you know, ideally you make this thing that has a life beyond you, and you put all this blood and sweat into it. But then, like, I hope now, like, Lebanon, PA was made over 10 years ago, and it's about a young girl considering getting an abortion in central Pennsylvania. And just back when it was in the festival run, I would have people come up to me, young women up to like 50-year-old women, who would come up afterwards and kind of after the Q&A and just say, like, you know, thank you for making that film. I had an experience like that, and I just, you know, and I loved your film, and I hadn't really talked about, or I hadn't really, this helped me process it in a way. And all I can hope is that, you know, 100 years from now, but even just like, you know, now, somebody finds it on iTunes, some, you know, teen girl or somebody finds this movie and watches it and it speaks to them. And that's kind of the amazing magic of it, that I'll never even meet that person, but it spoke to them and meant something to them. And that's why we do it, right? So that's, you know, it is hard, but occasionally it's worth it.
Thank awesome. You for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yay. We're Thanks done. Okay. Me. I'm going to press. Sorry. Wait, really quickly.
Yes.
How can people support you best? Sell your wares.
So yes, my website for our production company is reconstructionpictures.com. You have links to lots of things there, reconstructionpictures.com. The movies are Lebanon, PA, which is, all these movies are on most of the services. So you got your Vudu, your iTunes, your Google Play, your YouTube, you know, et cetera, either for rental or free. You can, you know, search in your Roku. I know Lebanon, PA is streaming a bunch of places for free, but Lebanon, PA, as in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, A Rising Tide, was just re-released, as Liz mentioned, on many services. It's even still on some cable providers right now. It's on like your on-demand box. It's on digital. All these things are also on DVD. Lebanon, PA is a beautiful Blu-ray for you very few collectors out there. The Blu-ray is the best edition of any of my movies. It's beautiful. And then my new movie is What We Found, and starring Elizabeth Mitchell and James Ranson and some other great people. And yeah, please just check out the movies. And then the final thing I'll say is if you like the movies, you know, get in touch. I'm very much here. So, you know, you can always drop a line on the Reconstruction Pictures website and be like, hey, I saw your movie and I loved it or I hated it or whatever. Because like I said, the reason we make it is to connect, is to have people respond to it. So I always love to hear what people think if you check it out. But please check out the movies. They're good movies. Got some. They're all solid Rotten Tomatoes, except for Lebanon, PA, which is 50-50. And like I said, it deals with a divisive issue, and it's a divisive movie in some ways. I think that's a big reason why it is so split, because I think in some ways it actually, we got a great New York Times review, but it's a divisive movie in America. But that's also kind of a good thing.
That's funny that it's exactly 50-50.
It's literally like unrotten.
55%, 44%, whatever, 50-50. That's hilarious.
And if you go read, well, the IMDb reviews are the are and the Amazon reviews are a great example of that, because there's a lot of like 4 or 5 star and a lot of 1 star. And you can just tell it basically, you know, not always. You can criticize a movie on its own merits, but it mostly comes down to somebody's view on abortion and legal abortion. And there are a lot of people who hate the movie for that reason who are very vocal on these things. So if you feel that way, then, you know, then great. And if you don't and you want to check the movie out and maybe give it a good review, you can also do that.
All right, this is time for the game. So if you had never listened to this before, which hopefully this is not your first episode, but it might be, this is a game that our producer Eric Toms came up with where he challenges us with an indie filmmaking quandary, a scenario, a challenge that we need to figure out as filmmakers. So Liz has not heard this question. This is the very first time that she's being asked this, and I'm just going to weigh in blind. So here we go. You've been approached by a financier who is looking to make their first film and is in need of a director. During the meeting, a few things become very clear. The financier is looking to make a film that is their life story and will star their son. It will not only be a vehicle for the son to make their acting debut, but also to aggrandize the financier. The story consists of a young man who is painted as brilliant in school, who has sex with many beautiful women, all of whom are quick to report that's the best sex of their lives, and is a genius business strategist. The financier has little to no self-awareness and zero empathy. The son has an incredible amount of bro energy and can only be described as a douchebag. They have a number of ideas as to how the film should look. It's made very clear that this is their way. It's their way or the highway. Needless to say, this shoot will be in a bit of a nightmare. However, they are prepared to pay your asking price upfront, and it means you get to make a feature film. It's very possible that the film could get made, but never find distribution, meaning if it ends up being an embarrassment, there's a chance no one will ever see it. You could also use the money to partially fund your next project. Do you A, agree to do the project and wrestle with a financier and their son in hopes of making a good film, knowing it'll be an uphill battle the whole way? B, pass on the project, saving your time and energy to focus on other projects? C, agree to the project, take the money and do whatever the financier and their son wants to do, knowing the film will be a piece of crap, then use a pseudonym so no one ever knows you were the director? D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
I think the only thing I do is I make sure that asking price covers a whole hell of a lot of things. Like, I would just make the movie. If someone's going to pay me meaningful money to make a movie, I would just make the movie and I would be a director for hire and I'd make the most out of it. I would learn from it and I'd find something joyful about it. But the only thing I don't want to do is I don't want to miss seeing my kids for making a crappy movie. So as long as there's a world where we can schedule the shoot where I get to see my children or bring them with me into town, and as long as my asking price really wasn't me lowballing myself, but me getting like a real director's rate, then yeah, hell yeah. Hell yeah, I'd make this movie. And then I would tell everyone stories about it for the next 20 years. And it would be hilarious. What about you, Alric?
Yeah, I love that answer. I think if you get the right amount of money and you can bring your family with you and it could be a fun experience for you and your family and you get to make a bunch of money and like you don't have to work as hard and you have a nice chunk for your next movie, like that's all great. And then maybe you get lucky and you connect with these people and you can find common ground and you can get some goodness into this thing, you know, and like do it tastefully. Because usually when people do these things, like they're like Eric said, there's no self-awareness. So like you can just be like, yeah, well, maybe this happens instead, or maybe they do this way. And, you know, just because someone has bro energy doesn't mean that they're going to be a bad actor necessarily or that they can't act. So I don't know. I would go for it and see what goodness can come out of it. As long as they're not trying to lowball me to do this, because that's what often happens with the people like this who like want to make a movie in this way. They have so much like belief in their own idea, and they can sometimes be arrogant. I've run into this a couple times where they feel like not only are you going to want to work on this movie, but you're also going to want to take a pay cut, and you're also going to want to work at for no money, and you're also going to want to do all these things because it's going to be a chance to make this thing that's so great. It's like, if it's that, then no. But if it's like, yeah, we'll pay you a real rate, and yeah, we're excited to work with you, and but we're gonna make, it's like, if it's all good, then yeah, go for it, do it.
Yeah, what I think, if Eric said and then they're mean, then it's a no. You know what I mean? Like if I know going in that they're mean people, or that they give all their money into the diamond slave trade or something like that, that it's like I don't know. But bro energy doesn't mean, you know, cocky doesn't mean, and yeah, extra money for our lifestyle sounds fantastic. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Let's make this movie, folks.
And zero empathy doesn't necessarily mean either. It just means that they are not aware of what's going on, but you know, maybe they're still a nice person. Anyways, what would you do in this situation? Let us know. Send us your questions, comments, or suggestions to podcast@mickeymoviesishard.com. Or if you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes, which would be amazing. Apple Podcasts now. Also, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast, and YouTube at Mickey Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimann, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week.